Even so, some of the B-17s barely made Oahu. On Lieutenant Carl Barthelme's plane, one of the crew accidentally flicked a switch which threw the plane north of its course, and by the time they figured out why, the gas needle wobbled at zero. Barthelme's turned hard south, and as he was approaching Oahu around 8 a.m., he was suddenly overtaken by 12 to 15 light planes marked with large red circles. They flew above, under, and alongside the B-17, apparently escorting the big plane in. The bomber's crew sighed with relief, removed the life belts they had put on while the plane was off course. They waved their thanks, but the pilots of the other planes were apparently too preoccupied to respond. About the same time, Major Landon was also flying in from the north. He had let one of his crew practice navigation most of the way, and they were heading west 150 miles north of Oahu when Landon finally took over. As he turned southward and approached the island, a flight of 9 planes came straight at him, flying north. For an instant, he too thought it was a reception committee. Then a burst of gunfire, a quick glimpse of the red circles, told him the truth. He pulled up into the clouds and shook off any pursuit. Most of the B-17s had no advance notice. Major Richard Carmichael flew in over Diamond Head, pointing out the sights to his West Point classmate Colonel Twaddle, the weather officer. As they passed along Waikiki Beach, they could see the smoke over Pearl, but assumed the Navy was practicing. Other pilots saw the smoke, too. Lieutenant Bruce Allen thought there was an unusual amount of cane burning. Lieutenant Robert Ramsey thought it was some sort of big celebration. They drew closer, and the devastation spread below them. Sergeant Albert Brawley gazed at the blazing rows of planes at Hickam and wondered whether some hot fighter pilot had crashed, setting them all on fire. Lieutenant Charles Bergdahl still thought it was a drill, complete with smoke pots and mock bombing, until he saw the remains of a smashed B-24 burning beside the runway. He knew the Army would never wreck anything so expensive. Now the planes were asking for landing instructions from the tower. A calm, flat voice gave wind direction, velocity, the runway on which to land, as though it were any other day. Occasionally, the voice observed without emotion that the field was under attack by unidentified planes. Lieutenant Allen was the first to land. Then came Captain Raymond Swenson's plane. As it circled in, a Japanese bullet exploded some magnesium flares in the radio compartment, which set the whole plane on fire. It bounced down heavily, the blazing tail section broke off, and the forward half skidded to a stop. Lieutenant Ernest Reed, the co-pilot, reacted to habit and set the parking brakes as usual. The crew all reached shelter except Flight Surgeon William Schick. A zero riddled him as he ran down the runway. Now it was Major Landon's turn to come in. The same nasal voice in the tower told him to land from west to east, and added laconically that there were 3 Japanese planes on his tail. With this encouraging news, he came on in, landing safely at 8:20. As the planes rolled to a stop, the men jumped out and raced for the boondocks on the Honolulu side of the field. Sergeant Brawley lay in the kaava bushes, listening uneasily as the bullets thudded around him. Lieutenant George Newton picked a swamp, Lieutenant Ramsey a drainage ditch. Lieutenant Allen tried to disappear into grass 3 inches high. Lieutenant Homer Taylor ran the opposite way, winding up in some officer's house under a couple of overturned sofas. The officer's wife and children huddled there, too, and every time a Japanese plane roared by, a small boy tried to get out from under the sofa and look outside. He would nearly get to the end of the sofa, then Taylor would grab an ankle and drag him back just in time. This duel continued until the end of the raid. Taylor had the right idea. Nothing was immune. Even the Snake Ranch, the new beer garden for enlisted men, exploded in a shower of glass and lumber. The only thing saved was a recording of San Antonio Rose. When the place was later rebuilt, it was the only record the old-timers allowed. The base fire department was now in action, but no fireman ever operated under greater handicaps. Bombs blasted the water mains, then the firehouse itself. As hoseman Howard King manned one of the engines, his crew chief, Joe Clagnon, suddenly yelled to look out. Before King could move, there was a blinding flash and something that felt like a ton of bricks. Lying in the smoke, he saw dimly the twisted engine, Clagnon dying, his own leg shattered. He begged a passing GI to put a tourniquet around his leg. The man said dazedly that he was sorry, but he didn't have a handkerchief. Through it all, Fire Chief William Benedict calmly directed his men, munching an apple. Soon he was hit, but the wound was minor. Then he was hit worse, but he got up again and continued supervising the work. The third time he stayed down, but as they carried him away badly injured, he was still munching the apple. Some of the casualties were needless. One first sergeant, in a well-meaning attempt to organize his unit, lined them up on the edge of the parade rounds just outside the big barracks. The target was too inviting to miss. A couple of zeros peeled off and strafed the men. Perhaps it didn't make much difference. The strafers seemed just as interested in individuals. One zero caught a lineman up a telegraph pole. He yanked out his spurs and slid down the pole as the wood splintered around him. Another strafer stitched up Hangar Avenue, sawed right through the cab of a swerving truck. Searching out targets, the planes swooped unbelievably low. Completely absorbed in his work, one pilot forgot about flying. As he skimmed along the parking ramp, his propeller tips flecked the asphalt. His belly tank scraped off and went scooting down the ramp. He finally pulled up, hitting the hills beyond the field, according to one man, crashing into the sea, according to another, getting away with it completely, according to a third. It's a wonder anybody noticed. The dive bombers were concentrating on the hangars, and most men were trying to get out of the area. A pack of men headed across the ball field for the post school building. A strafer caught up with them as they crossed the diamond. Private J.H. Thompson got two bullet holes in his canteen, one of his buddies in the bill of his cap, and others got off far worse. Corporal John Sherwood joined 200 others in a wild dash from the big barracks, which were perilously close to the hangars. They headed across the parade grounds for the post exchange, encouraged along by the inevitable zero. Sherwood, a compact little man, was clad only in undershorts and must have been a spectacular figure. His sergeant, Wilbur Hunt, still recalls how he paused in his work and wondered how anybody that short could run that fast. Today, Sherwood denies he ran, but says he passed at least 100 who did. From the shelter of the PX, Corporal Sherwood watched a master sergeant pedal furiously by on a bicycle. Head down, feet pumping hard, all the time shooting a .45 pistol in the air, he seemed curiously like a cowboy in a Wild West movie. Perhaps there was something of that spirit in the air, for out in the open near the married men's quarters, a group of small children were leaping up and down, shrieking, "Here come the Indians!" Gradually, fear and panic gave way to anger. A wounded man outside Hangar 15 kept shaking his fist at the sky in helpless rage. Sergeant George Geiger was bitterly mad, searched for a gun, any gun. He found one in the barracks supply room, but there was no ammunition. Then he heard there was a supply of arms at the main gate. When he got there, everything was gone except a .45 pistol holster. He took it, later gave it to a man who had a pistol, but no holster. Guns began to appear. Sergeant Stanley McLeod stood on the parade ground hammering away with a Thompson submachine gun. Staff Sergeant Doyle King fired another from under a panel truck. Technical Sergeant Wilbur Hunt set up 12 .50-caliber machine guns in fresh bomb craters near the barracks. His gunners turned up from an unexpected source. A bomb had blown off a corner of the guardhouse, releasing everybody. The prisoners dashed over to Hunt and said they were ready to go to work. It was just as he thought. The ones who are always in trouble are the ones you want with you when the going gets tough. He put them on the guns right away. Wheeler had its guardhouse heroes, too. All the prisoners were turned loose, and two of them helped man a machine gun on the roof. At the main barracks, men broke down the supply room doors, and three guns were firing from the narrow back porch. Somebody had set up another out in the open, toward the main road. PFC Arthur Fusco helped set one up in front of a hangar, but by now all the smoke made it useless. At one point, he took cover in the hangar office and was surprised to hear the phone ringing. He automatically picked up the receiver. A post wife was on the other end, asking what all the noise was about. Most of the men had no idea what to do or where to go. Staff Sergeant Francis Clausen, like the men at Hickam, was at least sure the hangar line was a poor choice. He ran toward the road, fell down, limped on. Then a solicitous chaplain stopped him, thinking he was wounded. That out of the way, he climbed a fence, lost his shoes, and lunged into some kaava bushes. At least a dozen others had reached the patch before him. PFC Carol Andrews was one man with a definite objective. A sergeant told him to hit for Schofield. He and a buddy started off through the non-com housing area, running in short spurts between the strafing. Once they ducked into the kitchen of an empty house. Bullets ripped the stove, and they marveled at the splintered porcelain. It was the first time they realized how the stuff could shatter. On they ran, and then another interruption. This time it was a soldier who had seen Andrews playing the organ for Catholic services. He asked Andrews to help him say the Catholic's act of contrition. He explained he hadn't been to Mass or confession for years and needed to make an emergency peace. Andrews stopped and repeated the words with him.